Hello and welcome to the latest IMI Talking Points podcast. My name's James Skoltok, IMI MotorPro editor. In this episode, we're going to look at how automotive always throws up debate and different viewpoints, some based on fact, some on fiction, online and in person. Joining me is IMI CEO Steve Nash to talk about where automotive is headed and why it's important to steer a sensible course through what can be a journey with a lot of diversions and dead ends. And as we edge closer to the end of the year, there's still a lot more for the IMI to pack in. So we'll take a look at what is on the horizon for the Institute. I like to give people lots of time to prep for these discussions, you know. Either that or I just like putting people on the spot so they have to think on their feet. I can't decide which. But I did think for this episode of the podcast, I thought it'd be nice just to sort of have a general talk about what's going on at the IMI, because there's so many things, you know. Off the top of my head, there's nominations for the annual awards. There's also IMI skills competitions going on this month as well. So there's quite a bit going on. And you've been on your travels too, haven't you? To some fairly, well, I describe as random events, but perhaps they're more linked to the stuff that we generally talk about than I'm giving them credit to.
Yes, I think it's sort of, you could say random, but not as random as it possibly sounds. So I was speaking at a conference at the NEC in Birmingham, which is called the Solar and Storage Conference. Mm. So, you know, it does what it says on the tin. I mean, it's predominantly about, renewable energy, how we produce it, how we store it. So it's, about big domestic and commercial batteries and things and, obviously solar, but other forms of renewable energy. But there was a whole section there on EV. And they asked me to go and speak about that. And to be honest, this went back, it was probably best part of a year ago they asked me to speak. And it's one of those ones where at the time, they were so keen for me to speak. When I said, well, look, let me be clear, this is what I would be speaking about. And they were going, yeah, that will be great. And I was thinking, really? Well, you know your audience, I don't. And then as it got nearer, you start thinking, God, I'm really busy. Do I really, why am I doing this? But actually, I got a good audience, a very attentive audience, and quite a few questions and so on. And you realise, actually, of course, there is a massive connection here. I mean, it's interesting because not so long ago, I was talking to, and I'm not suggesting this is or will be the case here, but, just to put things into broader context, I was talking to somebody from one of the industry bodies in Australia. And he was saying to me that they have a demand there for people who can look after solar energy system, domestic solar energy systems, domestic battery storage systems, and EVs, which are all part of the same ecosystem. Because they've got the ability for the car to be both taking and giving energy to the within the home, so you realise these things are not unconnected, no pun intended, but they aren't unconnected. they are. I think. I mean, one of the key things about the move towards the large scale move towards electric cars is where the energy comes from, and actually, contrary to what a lot of people say, and I find this interesting, actually. I mean, I'll go on and talk a bit more about this in a minute, but there's a lot of myth out there, so people say instantly, well, there's just not enough. If we all go electric, there's not enough power in the grid. That's not necessarily true. The problem is that we generate a lot of power quite often when we don't need it. Yeah. So how the hell do we store it until we do need it, until peak times? So if it's blowing a hoolie in the middle of the night, you've got wind farms that are generating all sorts of power, but you've got to have an appropriate storage mechanism in place to make sure that all that energy just doesn't simply dissipate. and that it's available at 6 o'clock in the evening when everybody gets home and plugs their car and their kettle in, you know, and their telly, you know. So it's, and I think on that subject of, you know, myth and counter myth, I was at a another trade bodies event, actually the following day, the day after I'd spoken at that conference. Somebody got up who was the a very senior person, head of a company that supplies important parts to cars, but they're not mechanical parts. I'm not going to give away too much, but you know, a key supplier and a household name. And he was there to talk about, you know, his products and specialist products, but gave the opinion that, you know, I'm a petrol head, I can't see electric being it, and it's, you know, the, it just ain't going to happen. And, you know, obviously they've delayed it to 2035, and I can see it being delayed longer, blah, 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 and I think hydrogen's the answer anyway. And then the host joined in and said, I tend to agree with you. And do you realise that if you know, take any multi-storey car park, if it was full of electric cars, it would collapse because of the weight. And then went on to say, and actually, if you had a traffic jam and on a lot of bridges, if they were, you know, if they had electric cars on them, they would collapse too. These being the same bridges, by the way, that take 18-wheeler trucks quite regularly. You know, it's total eyewash. It's total eyewash. But what I noticed was that a lot of the people in the audience were smiling and nodding along because it's what they wanted to hear. Because it's what they wanted to hear. And they were collectively like burying their heads in the sand. It was utter nonsense. You know, look, I mean, actually, the person on after me at Storage and Solar was a very interesting lady who represents... it's a federation of companies that produce e-fuels. Now, if I said to you, what do you think the E in e-fuels stands for? What would you say?
You put me on the spot now. I'm not sure I have an answer. What does the E in e-fuel stand for?
Well, you'd kind of think it stood for sort of environmental or eco or something like that, would you not? I did. And I thought at first she was wrong because it didn't make sense to me. She was saying it stands for electric. What it actually is all about is the fact that it is all hydrogen based, but it goes beyond the concept of actually running an engine on pure hydrogen, because there are lots of issues with that. Hydrogen is a tiny molecule; it's very difficult to contain. I tell you what isn't a myth. If you had an underground car park full of cars with pure hydrogen in them, that would be a bomb waiting to go off because they would all be leaking hydrogen. And that isn't a myth. What the E-bit does, it's about how they convert hydrogen into basically a synthetic version of what we have now. So, you know, the current standard petrol that most of us put in our cars is an E10 standard petrol. It's about using hydrogen to produce an E10 standard petrol, but that isn't carbon based. And for that matter, you could do the same with diesel or benzene or whatever. The flaw in this utopia is you need a ton of energy to do this. It only makes sense if that's green energy.
Well, exactly, because that's the thing, isn't it? When people talk about alternative fuels, not battery electric, whenever they talk about this, it is always, you know, they could really work really well, hydrogen, for example, but it's how you create the fuel in the first place. Because if like you say, you need a ton of energy to actually produce it, the greenness of it diminishes quite considerably unless the energy you're using is already green to produce it.
Yeah, and what we have to remember is that those, this is true, obviously this is true of batteries as well, but the aim is carbon neutrality. So it's about we're not putting any more carbon in the entire process, sort of well to wheel process. We're we're using a certain amount of carbon and we're not putting any more back into the atmosphere than was there already. So it doesn't reduce carbon, but it doesn't increase it at all.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, I mean, at the relatively recent, I mean, it's, you know, into November already, but at the recent British Motor Show at Farnborough, a couple of the companies that presented, we had a sort of Dragon's Den thing. Driver's Den, they called it, but I was one of the judges, and a couple of the entrants were synthetic fuel companies. And it's interesting that their focus was not particularly on new vehicles, it was on the existing fleet, you know, the 34 million cars that are out there, 39 million internal combustion engine vehicles, including trucks and so on, and how you could provide a carbon neutral fuel that they could run on. Without modification. So, look, I mean, I've never said that I didn't think that other things will play a part. I think they will. I thought this lady was particularly interesting, and we've asked her to do an article. We've actually asked her to do an article for MotorPro. We've said to her, suggested that she would be a good contributor, because I think it's a subject that as you know, James, only too well. I mean, our mission with MotorPro is to inform and educate, isn't it? You know, it's to give people. It's not to tell people. It's not to foist an opinion on people. It's just to give them enough information to make a reasoned, to form a reasoned opinion of their own, and to take away some of the bigotry that exists. You know, we've got no direct stake in electrification or any other solution. What I've always said, though, is that, you know, just look, I mean, as we said in our last podcast, you know, the government may well have slipped the timescale for banning internal combustion engine new internal combustion engine vehicles, but they haven't taken their foot off the pedal when it comes to insisting on the industry going electric, have they? Because the zero emission mandate, and so much money has gone into electric vehicles, and it's not without its problems. I think, you know, we all understand that lots of that is being reported, and I think that, you know, we're trying to do so much so quickly. You know, so we've got lots of things we need to sort out. We need to sort out, you know, the used car side of things. We need to give people confidence when they're buying a used one. You know, and I think some kind of standardised battery condition certificate is likely to come along. You know, likely to be mandated at some point. I think we need to sort out the insurance side of things. So at the moment, you know, for the tiniest external damage on a battery casing, we're writing vehicles off, and that's unsustainable. You know, so we have to have the skills out there for people to be able to open those batteries up and take a look at them and assess whether they are, in fact, there is any internal damage, and if there is, you know, is that repairable? You know, the batteries, when you open them up, are like lots of cells which are in packs, you know, and it may well be that you need a new pack of cells. You know, you wouldn't be into replacing them singularly, but because I believe there are sort of chemical compatibility issues if you do that. But if you were replacing a whole pack, you could imagine that being on an exchange basis, much the same way as we've done, you know, gearboxes and other units within cars to keep the cost realistic. So that rather than binning the old one and putting a brand new one in, you send the old one back and it gets reconditioned and goes back into the system. And, you know, it's a time honored process that works very well. And all those things, I mean, you know, if we were given 20 odd years to do this, those things would be put in place, you know, at the appropriate time, and we would do it. You know, we're trying to do 20 odd years worth of work in, you know, little over 10.
Yeah, and it's all multiple streams as well, isn't it? You know, we're trying to figure out the technology that powers the vehicles. We're trying to figure out the, like as you said, the insurance side of it, and we're also trying to figure out the recyclability of components as well, because like you said, if you need to remove parts of a battery pack, the raw materials can actually be recycled, or a large proportion of them can. So when they're pulled out and replaced, what is pulled out can then be become part of a kind of secular cycle. They're very round. A circular.
I think we all know what you're trying to say there, Joe. A circular system, I think.
I'll go with that one.
I think as well. I mean, look, you know, I wouldn't ever underestimate as well the efforts that are going into new chemistries which don't use, such rare. Nowadays highly controlled minerals, you know, that mostly belong under the control of China, you know. Mm. I mean, people are looking at things like lithium ferrous phosphate, you know, LFP batteries. They're looking at, there are so many different chemistries which are being looked at, nobody likes the idea that somewhere in a developing or yet to develop country, there are children digging out nasty things from the ground, you know, in order for us to have batteries in our cars. So, you know, that is being worked on. And I hear about, you know, electric motors without copper, you know, electric motors without any rare earths in the magnets and so on. You know, so these things are coming. But I think it wouldn't surprise me to see some other technologies come through as well. But I think we'll very much, electric cars are very, very much front and center at the moment and will remain a very, very significant part of our mobility going forward.
Yeah. And I guess from those two events that you mentioned, I guess it's important to remember, one, that we can't just sort of silo ourselves, because what automotive does can often be touch other industries and vice versa as well. But also, we always have to try and separate fact from fiction, because otherwise you just get this noise of nonsense, basically.
Well, I mean, there are people that you listen to because they clearly are, you know, very, very steeped in a subject. They're highly qualified, expert people who are worth listening to. And then there are people who may be highly expert in what they do, but they offer opinions on stuff they really don't know anything about, you know. So it is an unqualified opinion. And that's what concerned me when I heard this being said. And it was said two or three times within this meeting. And I said to the host, it's a very good meeting, by the way, on a lot of levels. But I said to the host afterwards, it would be really good if we could. I said, I worry about some of the messages your members were picking up, because they actually do need to be on this. You know, I mean, we've talked in previous podcasts about the fact that, you know, this zero emission vehicle mandate means that in some cases, certain manufacturers may actually have little option but to limit the number of internal combustion engine cars they bring in order to get the percentages right, because the cost of not getting those percentages right is so very, very high, you know. And there are various ways in which they can kind of mortgage, you know, their future achievements, you know, by buying carbon credits and stuff like that, and other solutions as well. But you can't go on doing that forever. At some point, you actually have to do it. You actually have to be producing cars that have zero tailpipe emissions, you know. And so there's no long-term way out of it. And by long-term, I mean between now and 2030, you know, which isn't very long, you know, and just beyond. So I hate the thought that a lot of the people in the audience were, broadly speaking, independent garages. And we know that they're very, very busy at the moment. I mean, and God, they deserve it, don't they? I mean, they took a massive bashing during the pandemic when many of them, you know, even if they were able to be open for so-called emergency workers, I mean, they were really strapped for work and so on, and MOTs were delayed and all that kind of stuff. So now they're racked out because we've got the oldest vehicle population that we've had in living memory, 10 plus years, and there's a lot of cars needing a lot of servicing. And, you know, so actually they're not thinking about training people at the moment. It's like, right now I've got to deal with what's in front of me. Plus, they're probably short people, because most people are, understand all of that. Somehow or other, though, we need them to understand that, you know, we all know this. I mean, God knows I've been in this industry so long, I've seen every cycle you could possibly imagine. or sickle, should I say? Sickle cycle.
Sickle, exactly. Yeah.
I've seen every type of, every kind of up and down you can imagine. Nothing lasts forever. And sooner or later, we'll work our way through the, you know, what's, you know, the park will get younger again, you know, as more new cars enter. And they'll have to engage with the new technologies if they want to, you know, a sustainable business. And you don't want to get there and find out that, you know, you're disqualified from doing that because you don't have appropriately skilled people. So, you know, we've got to try and keep people's focus on, you know, making sure that, you know, we have sufficient people out there. Because I tell you now, I mean, I've got no axe to grind here, because despite my background, I don't favour franchise dealers over independents, or vice versa. I've always said we as an organisation are about professional versus unprofessional. That's all. We're not about franchise versus independent, or, you know, people who are good and do a good job and are properly skilled to do it, whoever they are and whichever sector they're in, you know, we support them. But actually, electric vehicles need the same sort of competitive and broad support base that ICE vehicles need. And if a lot of people don't engage, you know, that business will be hoovered up by the people who will engage, and that will be predominantly the franchise dealers, because, you know, they've got no choice. You know, they're selling the thing, so they have to be properly equipped and trained. And so, you know, Gypsy's warning, if you like, that, you know, not to take your eye off the ball, you know, because, you know, it's the nature of our business. Whenever things are really good, you can't manage for the volume of business you've got, you know, remember the days when you wondered where the next job was coming from, and because they will come back, you know, so you need to be as broad-based as you can be to make sure that you're ready to take any work that's available.
Yeah, most definitely. So a seamless transition then into the IMI skills competition. How important is something like that to, well, I guess, one, encouraging people to keep skills updated, but also, I guess, you know, highlight the talent that is in the industry and upcoming into the industry?
Well, I mean, you've said it. I mean, I think, you know, the thing is, I mean, we're always, you know, our ongoing sort of regional campaign, There's More to Motor, you know, which we've talked about previously, is very much focused on, it's not addressing stereotypes specifically, it's just resetting people's perceptions. So we're not saying look, we're nothing to do with Arthur Daly or Phil Mitchell in EastEnders or whatever. We're saying, you know, that's all, you know, we've been saying that for years and that hasn't got us very far. What we're saying is, you know, this is what automotive is actually like, and these things really do exist. Skills competitions add to that, because we have some phenomenally skilled and talented people in this industry, and the skills competitions enable us to highlight that. Every year we get blown away by, you know, the people that come through and the skills and the knowledge that they have, and how diverse they are. I mean, last year's cohort that came through, and a number of whom got, you know, go on to sort of represent us at World Skills. So that's the UK skills competitions that go on, you know, to represent on the world stage. Came from such diverse backgrounds, and we had people, you know, and nothing had stopped any of them being as brilliant as they were. But we had a number of people with both with sort of visible and invisible disabilities, you know, neurodiverse, some physical disabilities as well, but that didn't get in the way of what they did. We had some brilliant youngsters. We also had some job changers, people who had changed careers and had come into the sector relatively late, but had really taken to it like a duck to water and had gone on to become fantastic at what they do and make a brilliant contribution. So, you know, and, you know, male, female, mixed genders, the whole piece. And so it really did highlight everything we're trying to say in the campaign, which is there's a job here for absolutely everybody. Doesn't matter what background you come from, you know, and there's not, well, it's not just the job, there are careers here to be had, you know. So yeah, the competitions are really important. And I mean, they mean a lot to us on that macro scale, you know, how we can sort of highlight and publicize that to help, you know, increase the attraction and of the sector. But also, I mean, it means a tremendous amount to the participants. I mean, they're amazing, you know. And don't forget, we're up against, we always medal. We always get people who go on to the World Skills Competition and come away with medals. And we're up against nations who actually take people out of the workplace and hothouse them sometimes for a year and just train them flat out. Yeah. Just for the competition. And none of our people do that. I mean, we give them plenty of additional help and training and so on, but they all have day jobs, you know. They all basically go back to their place of work. So, I mean, you know, any kind of medal that we win is worth, in my opinion, two or three times what some of those other people may win, because, you know, it isn't a level playing field in that sense.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, in that case, just to wrap up the questions then, I know I'm definitely in a future episode going to ask you to get your crystal ball out and predict what might happen in 2024, but we've still got 2 months left of this year yet. So I just wondered, what's on you in your diary? What's in your vision for November, December of 2023? What's in the schedule?
God, we've got so much, James, going on. I mean, actually, I would commend people to have a look at our policy watch, which is put together by our policy manager, Hayley Pelt, because there's so much in there. I was looking at the latest version of it yesterday. There's so much in there, but more than I would have time to sort of go through here. But we're engaged with all of the political parties at the recent party conferences. You know, we're very aware of the forthcoming election next year. So we've heard some policy announcements from the government. You know, whether they'll still be the government this time next year, who knows? But really important for us to be engaging with the opposition, which is an ongoing thing, because, you know, who knows, they could be in power this time next year. We're doing a lot in the Four Nations. So, you know, there are specific requirements in, you know, Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and, you know, and England too, of course. You know, we've been working with, I was up in Scotland last week, actually, at the Scottish Motor Trades Association annual dinner, and we're doing a brilliant schools engagement piece with them, which is something, you know, we worked in collaboration with the SNTA on. A ton of stuff. I mean, we're also at the request of the British government, we are doing a lot of work in China. This is for China in China. It's not about, so lest anybody should be concerned, it's not about equipping Chinese people to come and steal jobs here. It's about they need qualified people to work on the very rapidly growing population of electric cars over there. They simply don't have them. And they looked at our standards and said, well, yours are worldwide the best standard. And that's what we're helping them with, but very heavily engaged in that, and a lot of other countries as well who have seen what we've done with IMI TechSafe and said that's a solution that doesn't exist in our country, but we'd like to engage with it. So plenty going on internationally as well as nationally. But we've got to finish up the year strongly. You know, at the moment, this is the busiest time of the year for us, for engaging new students around qualifications and so on. And thus far, you know, the numbers are still looking strong. There's still a big job to do on getting more young people into the sector, but at least we're still seeing quite healthy numbers. around qualifications and apprenticeships. So, you know, plenty to be done. And of course, you know, as soon as we hit the new year, we'll really be focusing on MOT because, you know, although it's an all year round thing, it tends to peak in February and March, you know, January, February and March. And so that will be a big focus for us, is to help people through that process and, you know, get them back and ready and qualified to do the job that they do so well every day.
Yeah. So there's never a quiet time, really, is there? Everything is always 100 miles an hour. There's always something going on and something to focus on.
Well, there is. We're constantly talking to our sector advisory groups, you know, to who help us and assist us in you know, keeping all of our, you know, huge breadth of qualifications and accreditations and so on at bang up to date and all the appropriate CPD and everything else. So you know, it's a massive and ongoing job. And of course, you know, we've got some new senior team members in Lindsay Mitchell and you know, who's looking after the qualifications, and Tony who's taken over endpoint assessment, you know, who are driving that forward. So, you know, lots going on.
Great. Well, in that case, be prepared to dust off your crystal ball for the next episode so you can predict what will happen in 2024 then. But other than that, I think we've just about run out of time.
Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again on the next podcast.